Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
In the winter of 1873, a small band of prospectors lost their way in the frozen wilderness of the Colorado Rockies. Months later, when the snow finally melted, only one of them emerged. His name was Alfred G. Packer, though he would soon become infamous throughout the country under a different name, the Maneater. After the butchered remains of his five traveling companions were discovered in a secluded valley by the Gunnison River, Packer vanished for 9 years, becoming the West's most wanted man. What followed was a saga of evasion and retribution as the trial of the century worked to extricate fact from myth, and Pauly Pry, a once famous pioneering journalist, took on the cause of Packer. Maneater is the definitive story of a legendary crime, a gripping tale of unspeakable suffering, the desperate struggle for survival, and the fight to uncover the truth. The story that we're book that we're featuring this evening is Maneater, the life and legend of an American cannibal, with my special guest, journalist and author and professor Harold Schechter. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Harold Schechter.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much, Harold. For our audience, I just got to mention, this is Harold Schechter is one of the most prolific and important true crime writers, period. I'm going to say in America today, just period. So I thought I'd just say that for all those stuff.
Thank you.
And we'll talk about at the end how many books you have written so far, and it is, again, prolific. Let's jump right into this story. As you introduce in the very beginning of the book, you set the stage for the very, very, thorny subject of cannibalism, a subject that everyone seems to be horrified yet fascinated by. So let's talk about John C. Fremont and the mid-1800s in the American West, and tell us who John Fremont is and what's the situation, what is the reality like in the American West in the mid-1800s?
Well, I mean, the West was at that time completely unexplored territory. Very, very rugged, very, very primitive. This vast, vast unexplored wilderness. Fremont was known as the Great Pathfinder, was a person who was sent out to chart certain pathways through the West, in the company of Kit Carson, the legendary scout and Indian fighter, and his Fremont's books about his adventures. You know, most people today remember Lewis Clark, but in the 19th right. century, John C. Fremont was at least as famous as one of the great pioneering explorers who opened up the far reaches of the Western wilderness to white settlement and colonization. And Fremont himself became such a celebrated figure that he was nominated as the Republican Party's first presidential candidate in 1856. And one of the charges that was brought against him, you know, we think we're living through, a particularly nasty mud-slinging presidential campaign right now. But back then, as I say in my book, the charges that were leveled by politicians against each other make modern-day mud-slinging look like, you know, the height of civility. And one of the charges that was brought against Fremont was that he was a cannibal, which, unlike some of the other charges, that he was illegitimate, that he was an adulterer, that he was a native-born Frenchman back in the mid-19th century, as today people were, I guess they were kind of birthers around. But in any case, as it turns out, the cannibal charge was true, because on one of his expeditions, Fremont and his men became trapped in these snow-choked mountains. And when some of them died and the others were starving, they resorted to cannibalism. So, I mean, part of the beginning of my book, you know, what I do in the beginning of my book is put the Packer story in some kind of context, not only the context of, you know, the incredibly harsh circumstances that these early frontiersmen and explorers faced in the American wilderness, but just in the context of attitudes towards what's called survival cannibalism. You know, situations where men in extremely dire circumstances of extreme starvation have resorted to cannibalism as their only means of survival. And let me just interject. You know, I mean, I've written, as you know, about some of America's most notorious cannibal killers, most notably Albert Fish, you know, the infamous cannibal pedophile of the 1920s and 30s. The book Maneater doesn't deal with that kind of psychopathic serial murder cannibalism. It deals with a case of survival cannibalism and murder, but not serial murder.
Mm-hmm. Now, with this, you talk about, it's probably well known, about the gold rush in California, but as you write in the book, within about 10 years, they said the rivers were panned out and disillusioned miners were searching elsewhere. So in 1958, you talk about William Green Russell. Where do they resort to, and where is the new El Dorado?
It was actually 1858. It was in there were these various mineral strikes, gold and silver, in the Colorado Rockies, and a particularly rich strike of ore in the San Juan Mountains in southwestern Colorado. And that set off a second gold and silver rush that brought thousands of, you know, get-rich-quick hopefuls flocking to the mountains of Colorado. You know, there was a famous, one of them was Pike's Peak, and you'd have thousands and thousands of these people in covered wagons with Pike's Peak or bust written on the canvas canopies. So, you know, Packer became caught up in that kind of hysteria.
Now, with this as well, with this mining craze, we're not talking about a place that's not fraught with its own problems in terms of accessibility and danger. And the elements in terms of the weather in the winter, or weather in all the seasons. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, Colorado's, you know, a gloriously beautiful place. I actually lived in Colorado for a year myself. But, you know, the Rockies in the winter, and particularly back then, when it was largely uninhabited by, you know, white settlers, there were some cities like Denver and so on, but in terms of the San Juan Mountains, very, very few outposts of civilization. And in the winter, the conditions were incredibly harsh. You know, there might be 3 or 4 feet of snow in the grounds. There were these, you know, precipices and gullies and chasms. I mean, you really took your life in your hands trying to negotiate that landscape in the middle of winter. You know, that's what happened with Packer and his comrades. They set off very confidently in the belief that they could make their destination in a certain amount of time, and quickly found out that they had seriously underestimated the harshness of the environment and the severity of the elements.
Let's talk a little bit about this Alfred Packer. Very interesting. You talk about not it's his childhood, but you can get it back towards previous to, obviously, this fateful event where the men die and there's cannibalism.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about how James Packer from Salt Lake City comes to the Denver area, and under what circumstances, and why.
Okay. Alfred Packer, not James Packer. Packer was born in Pennsylvania. He always claimed to be related to a very prominent Pennsylvanian named Asa Packer, who was a railroad magnate and the founder of Lehigh University. That was one of the many fabrications that Packer indulged in. The family subsequently moved to Indiana. Packer left home at a relatively young age, in his mid-adolescence, and enlisted in the Union Army during the Civil War. Packer was afflicted, again, from childhood with grand mal epilepsy, and so he ended up getting a disability discharge. He was subject to very, very, very extreme and increasingly frequent seizures as a result of that illness. He reenlisted in a different unit. He was discharged again, eventually drifted out west. He claimed, again, apparently falsely, to have served with George Armstrong Custer. But in any case, many details of his past are shrouded in obscurity. But we do know that by the early 1870s, he had drifted around west. Again, he was doing some prospecting, making his living in various odd jobs. He eventually made his way to Utah, and that's really where the saga of Alfred Packer picks up.
Now, tell us the situation. You talk about, right in the introduction of the book, that the circumstances to which people would resort to cannibalism, and throughout the book you cite examples of not only historic examples and less known examples of cannibalism in America, but also
mm-hmm.
the prevailing attitude by society at that time towards
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, society was.
Go ahead.
No. Well, you know, society was, first of all, of course, it's always been a subject of incredible fascination to people, who respond with a mixture, with kind of titillated horror. The most famous case in American history, is the Donner Party, which happened some years before the Packer case. Depending on the character of the people who ended up having to resort to those extremities, the attitude could be fairly forgiving. In fact, one thing I discovered in my research is that cannibalism per se is not really illegal in virtually all states of the Union. So there are many, many instances, or significant number of instances in American history where people, again, who have been in these unimaginably nightmarish circumstances and driven half crazed by hunger and were near death by starvation themselves, and who resorted to surviving on the flesh of dead companions, those people have often been regarded fairly sympathetically by the public. There's a famous case, I just made a movie about it, the Welsh of Essex. which was very, very famous case. They made there was a book in the Heart of the Sea and a movie recently released about it. It was one of the inspirations for the book Moby Dick, you know, where these sailors who were stuck on this lifeboat, you know, ended up surviving by cannibalizing their dead comrades. And, you know, those people were not only not punished, but again, you know, treated very sympathetically.
Now, you also introduced the situation, the circumstances in which Alfred Packer joins this group of people. Again, there is a mix of some of the storytelling he does about his background. Mm-hmm. And to that testament, he does a little bit of this, trying to describe himself as a guide. So in with this little tale about him being a guide, how does he impress these people enough so that they can take him on board? Because there was an amount of fee that was required to be joining this journey. So tell us how he circumvented that and how he came to be included.
Well, you know, there was a group of about 20 miners who were all living around Bingham, Utah at the time. And, you know, Packer got wind of the fact that they were organizing an expedition to the San Juan Mountains to prospect for silver. And Packer, who, as you said, had no money at the time, offered his services as a guide, claiming that he had spent a lot of time in the area. And he had, in fact, spent some of his time in Colorado, for sure, and that he would be able to lead them to their destination in a very short time. None of the other men among these other 20 miners had ever been to Colorado. So they were willing to, this one prospector, whose name was McGrew, you know, kind of took a shine to Packer, was willing to grub stake him, as you put it, that is, you know, pay his way in return for, you know, Packer helping him out with his horses and so on, but also, you know, his services supposedly as a guide who could lead them to where they wanted to go in a matter of, you know, a couple of weeks.
Now, with this, these people had seen people perish before because of starvation, so these people set out to calculate and then acquire enough supplies that they wouldn't starve.
Right.
Tell us how it was that with the supplies, but also was this a dangerous or not dangerous time to be going, and did anybody advise against leaving at that time?
Well, when they initially set out from Bingham, Utah, you know, they left, I'm trying to remember exactly, I think they set out in November 18, 21 men, including Packer, set out from Utah in November 1873. And again, Packer assured them that they could make the journey, within a month, so that they would arrive there, you know, again, before, according to him, you know, the harshest part of the winter. In the event, they didn't get to the area for 3 months, because it rapidly became clear that Packer had no idea how to get where they were going. So the supplies that they equipped themselves with, you know, were all based on this estimated time that Packer had given them, which was, you know, severely. Underestimated. And then also they felt that they could probably, you know, supplement their supplies by killing game along the way. But again, the weather was so much harsher than they had anticipated that they encountered very, very, very little game to kill.
Important part of this story, too, is the fascinating history that's included in this amazing story. And about, if I'm pronouncing it right, the UTs, UTs Indian.
Yeah. Utes,
and
I believe. Yeah.
Utes. The Utes Indians of Colorado. And you also include the incredible history of the negotiation and how much land that they had owned and negotiated successfully for, but also their experience in living and surviving this often harsh area. So tell us a little bit about that story, about these unique Indians and their connection to this story.
Well, I mean, the Utes were this loose confederation of different tribes who were populating this really vast area of the Colorado Territory. And, of course, you know, we all know the, you know, very, very sorry history of, you know, of white American expansion into those, into that frontier. You know, as soon as any valuable resource, you know, gold, silver, whatever, was discovered on Ute territory, there would be this incredible incursion of white American settlers. And, you know, increasing conflict between the whites and the Native Americans. You know, the Indians were constantly forced into this position, you know, of having to negotiate these treaties, which would guarantee them supposedly in perpetuity, you know, all this land. You know, but as soon again, you know, again, as soon as somebody discovered more gold or silver on the Indian reservation, there would be another invasion of white settlers. And, you know, the Indians, you know, this land that had been promised to them forever, they suddenly had to be renegotiated. And, you know, their reservations became smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. There was a very, very remarkable figure named Chief Ouray, who became sort of the designated chief of the Ute Nation, and who, you know, was a figure that, you know, the white America and some of his own people had somewhat different feelings about. You know, some of his own people, I guess, saw him kind of as what later came to be called an Uncle Tom, who was betraying them. You know, to the whites, he was, you know, this, no, you know, this, well, he was called a friend to the whites. But, you know, he was kind of a visionary person. I mean, he understood that, you know, he was between the proverbial rock and a hard place. I mean, he understood that, you know, without negotiating these treaties, his people are just going to be totally exterminated. So that was the native population that, you know, that Packer and his, companions, and all the white prospectors and settlers to the area, you know, had to confront and deal with.
Now let's talk about how it gets down to its five companions and himself, including George Noon and Lutzenheiser and his friend McGrew, who really was pretty sympathetic, and sort of the attitude, what did they think about Alfred Packer after they realized he really wasn't much of a guide and they didn't have much to eat at all?
Well, I mean, some of the men, there's a guy named Lutzenheiser, as you mentioned, another guy named Nutter in particular. You know, some of the men had this antipathy toward Packer from the beginning. You know, I don't think Packer had the most winning personality. And according to, again, some of the people he was traveling with, you know, he seemed to be displaying kind of suspicious interest in the amount of money they were carrying with them. And, you know, they also felt that he was hogging much of their increasingly diminishing provisions. So there were a few of the men there who really bitterly disliked and distrusted Packer, even before it became clear that he had completely misled them into thinking that he could serve as a guide. The people he was traveling with, this guy Bob McGrew in particular, fell much more warmly towards Thacker and felt sorry for him. The other thing, again, were these terrible seizures that Thacker was subject to, which some of the men, were really, really, really put off by, unsettled by, in a very, very deep way. I mean, they found it very, very disturbing. McGrew was much more sympathetic and would really tend to Thacker when he was in the throes of one of these seizures. But Thacker definitely, even again before it became clear that he really had no idea where he was going, had made enemies among those men.
So in fairly short order, certainly a lot sooner than they thought, they were already considering eating one of their horses. So we're talking about they went from a completely different state of mind and mode in if they're mm-hmm. considering their horses. So tell us about the first decisions to eat something other than and you talk about eating things other than animals as well. So
well, as I said, Thacker had promised he would get them to their destination in the San Juan Mountains, from Utah, in less than a month. And they had equipped themselves accordingly with provisions. It's a little unclear. I mean, even they probably were undersupplied even to that extent. Again, they were hoping to encounter much more game than they did. So by the time they actually finally did reach the San Juan Mountains of Colorado, they had been reduced to eating the horse feed. I mean, they had eaten their horse's grain. They were really in a state of near starvation. They were, yes, as you said, on the brink of killing their own horses and eating their own horses. And then they were saved by a sudden encounter with Chief Ouray and a band of his Indians, who then very hospitably invited them into, Ouray invited them into his camp, and the men set up their quarters there and engaged in some trade with the Indians. And Ouray invited them and advised them to remain with him at the Indian camp until springtime and the snow melted.
And what did they do with that advice after almost succumbing to starvation? What did they took that hospitality and they strengthened themselves and mm-hmm. but what did they do with that advice?
Well, a number of them, this guy, people called him Lott. His name was Lausenheiser. Lott and four other prospectors, really after just about a week or so, began to get very, very antsy and decided that they were going to set out and try to make it to this nearby Indian agency. And so they did that. I mean, Ouray strongly advised them not to do it. And in fact, communicated to them very emphatically that he thought that they would never make it there alive. But they ignored him. Greed, I guess, is a great, great motivating force in human behavior. These guys were very, very eager to make it to this this mining spot and get started. So they set out into the wilderness. Thacker actually tried to follow them, but Lott was one of these people who was so hostile to Thacker that he actually drew a gun and threatened to kill Thacker if Thacker followed them. So Lott and these four other guys set out in the snow. And then a few days later, Packer and five other men followed in their wake.
Incredible.
Yeah.
So this is, they set out from that duty camp in the second week of February. And so, and as you mentioned, they've got the youngest and the oldest of prospectors. Israel Swan is a man in his 60s. They have 16-year-old George California Noon. You've got a butcher named Frank Reddy Miller, and you've got a woman named Shannon Wilson Bell.
Shannon Wilson Bell is not a woman.
Oh, pardon me. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yes, and also James Humphrey. So tell us about their plight. What happens early on in this journey that, and what are the conditions? They know that there may be snow, but what are the real snow conditions in this?
Well, again, you know, you have to imagine trying to traipse through a completely uncharted mountainous wilderness, basically in, you know, like two or three feet of snow. I mean, you know, snow coming up to your thighs, sometimes snow coming up to your waist, you know, with really only the vaguest sense of all, you know, of where you're going, you know, and what direction you're heading, you know, and again, equipped with enough provisions, you know, to maybe last for a few days. You know, they very, very rapidly, you know, ran out of food. They were, you know, frozen. They were starving. You know, they were basically vulnerable, you know, to the most, you know, to the harshest kinds of, you know, winter environmental conditions imaginable. So that was the position they found themselves in very, very rapidly. Of course, you know, the way the story unfolded and the way I tell the story in my book is, you know, Ure and the other men who remained at Ure's camp, you know, saw Packer and these five other people you mentioned heading off into the wilderness on their way supposedly to this Indian agency, which was supposedly they were going to reach in less than a week. And then the next sighting of Packer, the next time anybody saw Packer, was 3 months later. You know, 3 months later in April, when he emerged from the wilderness by himself and made his way to this Indian agency. And the other five men that he was with were not there, and in fact never seen alive again.
You also have a chilling part of your book when you talk about in late March or early April that, again, a small party of UDs with some women among them said they came upon a white man camped by the Gunnison River cooking his dinner, meat on a stick, and then apparently they went to see what he had thrown in on the riverbank or in the river, and tell us what it was that they found.
Yeah, this band of Ute Indians, as you say, you know, came this white guy roasting something on a fire, and when he saw them approach, he tossed it into the river, and ran away, and they fished it out of the river, and it was a cooked human arm. So. So that was the only reported sighting of Alfred Packer in the 3 month period from the time he and his five companions left Chief Ure's camp, and when he showed up at the Indian agency in April.
Now it's interesting and it's fascinating, and again. Truth's much stranger than fiction. You talk about the Indian agency Los Pinos, and by the time he gets there, not shortly after, it's amazing you're writing a book, who is he met by? And then right away there is some initial suspicion and there is a story demanded from Packer almost immediately after arriving there. Tell us about this altercation and incident.
Well, as you say, when Packer reached, Packer reached Los Pinos and almost immediately afterwards, Preston Nutter, who is one of the guys who had, been hostile to Packer from the very, very start,
right.
suddenly showed up. Nutter and three other men had very wisely taken Chief Ore's advice and remained at the Indian camp until the snow melted and then set out. And just by happenstance, 2 weeks later, they arrived at the Los Pinos agency just hours after Packer showed up. As I said, Nutter was one of these people who was always very, very suspicious of Packer from the beginning of his motives. Packer, and he wanted to know where these other five guys who had set off with Packer were. And Packer told him that he, Packer, had developed frostbite in his feet and had become snowblind and was holding the other guys up. So they had left him behind with a rifle and they had set off into the wilderness and he'd never seen them again. He had just somehow managed to survive by himself for all that time. And then made his way to Los Pinos, but he claimed that he had no idea where the other five guys were.
Right away, this Nutter is Preston Nutter is a suspicious and skeptical of the story itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can tell us about what some people for the other journey were the unusual questions that he was asking about money, but also. What Preston Nutter notices as a possession of Packer at
mm-hmm.
this Indian agency. What does he notice?
Yeah. Oh, well, he noticed that Packer had in his possession a big skinning knife that had belonged to the German butcher. Was known as, well, Frank Reddy. They called him Reddy Miller. Packer had some story about that. He said that Packer had just stuck it into a tree and left it behind when the five other guys had gone off into the wilderness. So that seemed, again, a very, very dubious story to Nutter. Miller would leave his knife behind. So,
now, in terms of the story that he does say, and of course, this story is an evolving story. He isn't immediately really suspected of much until some things happen. So, tell us how the story proceeds in terms of any kind of holes to this story.
Well, after. Spending a little time at Los Pinos, Packer and the other men went to this nearby town named Sawatch, where Packer holed up in a saloon proceeded to live kind of high on the hog. I mean, spending a bunch of money gambling and drinking and treating themselves to various delicacies like canned oysters. This struck the other men as very, very suspicious because, they knew Packer had been so broke to begin with that, he'd had to basically barter his services in order to accompany the men. So they became very, very, very suspicious. of Packer's free spending ways, again, given how poor he had been before, and began to wonder where all this money had come from. And eventually, well, you know, very quickly, you know, Nutter in particular came to be convinced, since there was no sight of these other men, you know, became convinced, you know, Lot and his companions, who had set off before Packer and had also run into a lot of trouble, you know, but they had finally made it to the Indian Agency. So the only ones missing and unaccounted for were Packer's five companions. And again, Packer suddenly seemed to be, you know, inexplicably prosperous. So Nutter became convinced that Packer had murdered these other five guys and stolen their money.
And as a result, what does he do, and what does Packer do?
Well, you know, I mean, Packer was really afraid that, you know, he was in danger of being lynched. Just around that time, while they were in Sawatch, the head of the Los Pinos Indian Agency, a guy named General Charles Adams, showed up, and Nutter conveyed his suspicions to Adams, and Packer at that time was still insisting, you know, on his original story. But then finally, Packer's story changed.
Now, this questioning by Adams gets what initial admissions from Packer regarding the death of these five men?
Well, what came to be known as Packer's first confession was, you know, it's important to keep in mind, because if you look up, you know, if you Google Alfred Packer, you come across a lot of these websites that claim that he was the only American ever convicted of cannibalism in the history of the United States, which is not true. Packer never denied, well, except for his initial, you know, his initial claim that these five guys had left him in the wilderness and that he'd never seen them again. But from the time of his earliest confessions, he never denied that he had engaged in cannibalism. What he did claim, however, is that he was completely innocent of murder. According to his first confession, after a short time, Israel Swan, who was the, as you pointed out, the oldest of this group of six people, died of exposure, and the other five men, Packer gave a very, very harrowing and probably pretty accurate description of the state of near starvation that they were in. They had been reduced to the point of boiling their own moccasins and eating them. They were trying to gather tree sap from the roots and eat that. They were eating whatever stray rosebuds. I mean, they were scrounging around the rivers for snails, which they actually couldn't find. So they were in an extremely, extremely, you know, dire straits. And, Packer said that Humphrey had died of exposure, and the other five men had eaten his flesh and then left the corpse where it lay and proceeded on. And then after a little while, a second man, I think Humphrey, had also collapsed and died of exposure. And then the remaining four men had dined on his flesh, and so on and so forth. Packer claimed that Shannon Wilson Bell killed, I forget which one, probably California Noon, and then Packer had you know, gone ahead and eaten Noon's flesh. And then at the end, Packer and Bell made a pact that they would neither would try to kill the other. But then, in fact, Bell tried to kill Packer, and Packer had killed Bell in self-defense. So that was his first confession. In other words, he freely admitted to cannibalism, denied that he had committed murder, admitted that he had killed Bell, but only in self-defense. And he also claimed, very importantly, that each one of the four guys that had been successively cannibalized, that their bodies had just been left in the places where they had died.
Yeah. Now, and you talk about in 1874, they find the five bodies. And so mm-hmm. what is proven or disproven or proven and disproven at that time with that discovery of those five bodies?
Well, eventually what happened was Packer, by the way, in the Packer was, you know, put in jail. Packer said he would lead Lod and Nutter and this other group of guys, you know, to the places where these bodies were and to the
right.
place where he had killed Shannon Wilson Bell. And then he started out, and then he refused to do it. And they brought him back and locked him up in, well, what passed for jail. It was just really a little shack. And he actually escaped and remained at large for 9 years. Anyway, not too long after he escaped, there was an illustrator for a very, very popular publication at the time called Harper's Weekly, who was on assignment doing sketches of the Colorado mining area. And he came upon what had been a campfire with five horrendously decomposed and mutilated corpses, still all lying in their you know, sleeping blankets and so on. It immediately became clear that these were the five men that Packer had set out with. So an examination of the corpses showed that their skulls had all been crushed. Flesh had obviously been removed from their bodies. They could tell, you know, by the knife marks on the bones and so on. Packer's story that these five, you know, these guys had died one after another, these natural deaths, and they'd eaten the bodies and left them where they lay, it was obviously a complete lie. All these guys had been, well, four of them anyway, had clearly been killed in their sleep. One of them, Shannon Bell, apparently his body was a little farther off. His skull had also been crushed. So it was very, very evident that these five men had been horribly murdered, at least four of them in their sleep, and then butchered for their flesh. And obviously the leading suspect in the case was the only person who had survived, Alfred Packer, and he immediately became the most wanted man in the West. He was known as the Man-Eater.
What were a couple of the other names for him that were just as interesting or more so?
I think they called him the Human Hyena. They called him a ghoul. You know how it is. I mean, whenever there's some horrific murderer at large, the press immediately comes up with very colorful, often gothic supernatural horror nicknames for them. So Human Hyena sticks in my memory, and I'm sure they called him a ghoul. I can't remember. Maybe you remember some of the others, but
those are the ones, the Human Hyena and the ghoul.
Yeah.
How is it that he comes to be captured? Who recognizes mm-hmm. him, and what is he doing at that time while there's this huge manhunt in America for him?
First of all, he assumed a pseudonym, Swartz. He was roaming around the West. He was out in Wyoming. He was supporting himself in various ways. He was, you know, doing some, well, he continued to do some mining. He, you know, Packer actually, he had been trained as a leather worker. So he was, you know, did some saddle making and so on and so forth. But 9 years after the events just related, in 1883, one of the former members of the original 21-man party that Packer had been part of, a guy named Frenchy Cabazon, who at that time was working as a, you know, kind of a drummer, a traveling salesman, was stopping at a boarding house in Fort Fetterman, Wyoming, and he heard in the adjacent room somebody speaking in this weirdly high-pitched voice. That was one of the distinguishing characteristics of Packer. Apparently, it's a not uncommon symptom of severe grand mal epilepsy. That some of the, you know, some of the people afflicted with it have these very high-pitched voices. Anyway, Cabazon recognized this guy who was calling himself Swartz as Packer, and he notified the authorities, and Packer was arrested and taken back to Colorado for trial. And, of course, this was a great, great, great sensation, not only locally, but really nationally. You know, the capture 9 years after his escape of the notorious man-eater.
We don't have all the time that we'd love to go into this, but tell us about the highlights of the trial in terms of the people there that made the most damaging testimony and did show an incredible amount of animosity and personal investment in the trial and the outcome.
Well, again, you know, Packer, when he was captured, you know, changed his story once again. You know, he claimed that, and it was something he more or less stuck to for the rest of his life. You know, he claimed that, all of them were on the brink of starvation. He had gone off one day to climb a mountain to do some surveillance, you know, see if he could get some glimpse of the agency they were heading for, and that when he returned to the camp at dusk that day, he found Shannon Wilson Bell roasting some human flesh on a fire, and the other four men lying there dead, and then Bell jumped up and attacked him, and Packer killed Bell in self-defense. So that was his story. That was Bell who killed the other four men, and then tried to kill him. And he had shot and killed Bell in self-defense, and then he had, you know, made a little lean-to for himself and remained there for the next few months, living off the flesh of the dead bodies that, you know, again, that Bell had killed. At his trial, you know, again, there were, you know, there was, you know, this very, very, very devastating testimony against him by Lott and Nutter. There was so much prejudice against Packer by that point, you know, that Packer received nothing like a fair trial. You know, one of the interesting things to me about the Packer case is I came to believe, although it's still very much an open question that people continue to debate, you know, that Packer probably was guilty of murdering these five guys. Although there are other people, again, who feel very strongly that he wasn't, but that's my best guess anyway. But nevertheless, whether, you know, he did or not, he definitely did not receive a fair trial, because, he, you know, he was being made to prove his innocence, which, of course, is not how American jurisprudence works. You know, there are certainly a lot of reasonable doubt, you know, that his lawyer raised, but there was so much prejudice against him. The testimony of people like Lott and Nutter, you know, who claimed, and not only that Packer had killed these other people, but that he had deliberately led them into the depths of the wilderness in order to slay and rob them when they're at their most vulnerable. And Packer didn't do himself any favors. I mean, Packer was a very, very, very prickly personality at best. And he gave this long, elaborate testimony, in which he was barely able, to keep his own ugliest impulses in check. So
it is interesting to see how he thought he could control the courtroom, and for the great part of it, he did. He made a statement that would be akin to a lawyer making an opening statement, and
yeah.
And again, he was indignant throughout
all of this,
basically.
Yeah, he was indignant, that's true, and, possibly very justifiably indignant. I mean, no doubt justifiably indignant, because, he realized the stack, all the cards were stacked against him. Although at some point, he seemed to feel in the beginning that he was, might get acquitted. He was actually even, possibly making plans to marry one of the local women, since, his trial, the trial of most, notorious accused killers, attracted a number of, what later came to be called groupies. But yes, he was indignant, at the charges that were made against him, and also very indignant that, that nobody in the courtroom could possibly really understand the kind of, horrendous circumstances that, that he and the others were suffering. Subsequently, in the mid-20th century, and particularly after the Second World War, there were very, very famous studies done about the effects of starvation on human behavior. And it really drives people crazy and reduces them to a state of really kind of primal savagery. It's just very, very, very hard to know ultimately whether Packer's story as he told it was true or not. It just seems to me, it's always seemed to me very, very suspicious that it just seems to me that it was a little too convenient that Packer would go off for the day and come back and find these other men had been killed and were just lying there, neatly ready to, serve as 4 months worth of food supply. And some other guy had done it. And then Packer had just killed this other guy in a way, that also seems not totally impossible, but a little implausible. So I came to the, my best guess, which I'm ready to admit might be totally wrong, is that Packer was in fact guilty of murdering these guys. But again, that said, he still did not receive anything remotely like a fair trial.
And in that, you do talk about this interesting legal development where they fight for another trial and then he's convicted of manslaughter, but due to the pressure, he's given this unprecedented sentence, and again, we don't have that. We don't have all the time to go into this, but I'm going to leave the readers and the listeners of this show to know that this is just. There's so much more to this story, and one of the things I just wanted to ask you about, and I guess or you could comment about, was the incredible juxtaposition between the fascination, and he's selling souvenirs in prison, things that he's little trinkets he's made, and people want to come and visit him. So there's sort of a juxtaposition between the bloodthirsty media and then society's fascination and almost admiration of the guy in a lot of ways, and then also that the media wasn't exactly in a concerted effort on board in terms of the persecution of this person. And that comes to the point where you get Pauly Pry sort of going the other way, making statements that a journalist, a responsible journalist, wouldn't make. So just tell us about that sort of whole incredible dynamic in America at that time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you know, one thing you learn when you research these cases going back to the 1800s and even earlier, you know, is that the public fascination, you know, with sensational murders and cannibalism and so on and so forth. You know, we sometimes think that that's just a product of modern society. And, you know, I mean, obviously right now we're living at this moment when, you know, there's all this, media obsession with true crime. But, you know, the only difference between now and then is, you know, technological. I mean, you know, now you have like podcasts like Serial covering true crime, you know, but they didn't have that back then. You know, but the public appetite to read about these kinds of horrendous crimes, you know, and to maybe even, you know, get some kind of memento of the crime. You know, there's nothing at all new about that. I mean, that's always existed. You know, there was always some difference of opinion among journalists about whether Packer was dear or innocent and how fair a trial he received. As you said, he was originally sentenced to death. He was going to be hanged. And then his lawyer managed to get that conviction overturned on a legal technicality, and he was retried. He couldn't be retried for murder. That would be double jeopardy. So he was tried and convicted of 5 counts of manslaughter and given 8 consecutive 8-year sentences for a total of 40 years, which was essentially a life term. He was in his 30s right by then, maybe even a little older. But then this very crusading Denver journalist named Polly Pry, who was doing an expose on prison conditions in Colorado, encountered Packer and, you know, of course, knew how notorious he was and interviewed him. And she became convinced that the story that he told was the truth. And you know that Bell had killed these other guys, that he had killed Bell in self-defense, you know, that he had cannibalized the corpses. But you know, again, there were other cases, notorious cases of that kind of survival cannibalism. You know, the people had not been prosecuted anyway. So she set about. She launched this crusade to get Packer pardoned. And ultimately he was paroled and then lived out his last few remaining years, you know, kind of as a, well, sort of something of a little local celebrity. You know, by then, you know, the West of the frontier, you know, is already, you know, turning into a kind of mythic thing. And Packer seemed like one surviving, you know, relic of this, you know, past. And, you know, when these brave frontiersmen, you know, would venture into the wilderness and deal with these horrible conditions and so on and so forth. So, you know, and he died still insisting on his innocence and then, you know, entered into the realm of American legend.
Absolutely. And I wanted to say, too, for those people that they're going to discover this book, that you also talk about basically, and again, it is not with, there's not one shred of anything that happens in this book that isn't without controversy, that there's an exhumation made. And
mm-hmm.
still,
yeah.
And so that would
yeah.
be for the people to discover themselves. That there is, again, this case fascinated people right from the very beginning, and in various ways the media picked up on it, and he went from reviled to hero, to reviled to hero,
mm-hmm.
to myth, to the butt of jokes and
mm-hmm.
curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like you say, he has gone on to be an infamous legend in American history. So.
Yep. He's, you know, part of American folklore.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Maneater, the life and legend of an American cannibal. And for those, Harold, again, how many true crime books do you have under your belt now? What's this number, if you can remember?
I'm going to say a dozen, but yes, I'm going to say a dozen.
And for those that are going to look up your record in terms of your work, you've written about some of the, if not almost all of the important cases in America in depth,
mm-hmm.
and fascinating, again, definitive accounts of some of the most heinous villains in America. So I want to thank you very much. Harold, for coming on again, once again, and joining us to talk about Maneater, want to thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Do you have a website?
Thank you.
Do you do Facebook?
I don't do Facebook, but there is a haroldschechter.com website. I think I do have a Facebook page, which I never go on, but that somebody else maintains for me, so people can contact me that way.
Yes. Well, again, thank you very much, Harold. Good to talk to you. Thank you very much, and you have a great
thank you.
Evening.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan. Appreciate it. Bye.
Bye-bye.